Harvey Weinstein is trying to find a jury of his peers. Chief Justice John Roberts gives his year-end report card on the federal judiciary. Spoiler alert, not everyone passed. And CNN settles Nick Saban's defamation lawsuit. Apparently, CNN wanted out of the fake journalism business. Well, these stories, plus we look ahead at the Comedian of Law's first annual Academy Awards show, where we give out our awards for the best and the worst legal movies. All right, well, thank you so much for coming back here to our podcast. I know we've taken a little bit of time off as we went through our November and December CLE season, but while we were away, I did a lot of traveling, and I travel the United States over teaching lawyers using humor in our classes. We have a lot of fun doing it, and you never know the interesting people that you might meet along the way. And I was in Philadelphia, and then I met Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, welcome to our podcast.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, because I do guys share this story, because here's how I always start off my classes. I do this joke, and I make this joke about how dreadfully boring CLEs are and can be. Now, would you agree with that in your history as a lawyer? Have you not encountered a lot of boring CLEs?
Oh, absolutely. 99%. Yeah.
And now, for those of you who don't know, CLEs mean continuing legal education classes. As lawyers, we have to get continuing education classes every year. So I always start off with this joke that, yeah, lawyers, we procrastinate. It's the end of the reporting period. You look at the calendar, and there's aviation law on that side of town. There's ERISA law on that side of town. Yeah, no. Which one could I bring my pillow to sleep through? And I make fun of aviation lawyers. I've been doing that for 5 years. And finally, I teach this class. I drop that joke. And Mackenzie, you end up being an aviation lawyer.
I felt so personally attacked. It was like 2 minutes into the class. And here we're going with microaggressions like right from the jump. And, you know, I had to speak up. Like, I have to defend my sector of the law. And we're not always boring. Sometimes
no.
It can be a little dry for, you know, people, novices who don't know anything about it, but so, I enjoy my practice.
So what is aviation law?
I mean, really, it can be anything. I think typically in CLEs, it's aviation and aerospace law, which is such a huge category. It includes these days things like drone regulation and drone law, which I don't practice, but can be, you know, a little cutting edge. But it can be anything from airline representation, cases about people getting injured on flights, or in my practice, most of what we do is we represent engine and component manufacturers in product liability cases.
I wanted to say you proved my point that aviation law is a snooze fest, but I think you actually proved me wrong. You just mentioned two things that are fascinating to me. I remember this was a couple of years ago that a certain person went on a flight, I think it was United Airlines, and got beat up as they drug him out of that airplane. I guess that involves aviation law.
Absolutely.
So what about if a drone is flying over my backyard, can I shoot it out of the sky if my neighbors are trying to peep, you know, sneak a peek as to what we're doing on our property?
So I guess the short answer is it depends on what kind of drone, it depends on what state you're in, maybe, and definitely what country you're in, and depends on how high the drone is flying. But, you know, not going to give you legal advice, but just like go for it. It's fine.
Well, I take everything back now. I actually am fascinated about aviation law. Maybe we need to include a segment. When you talk about drones and getting a black eye on a flight, then I think, hey, you've got my attention. Well, it is time for New Year's resolutions. The New Year's upon us, and it's time to make New Year's resolutions. And so, Mackenzie, do you have any New Year's resolutions as you look forward to 2020?
You know, this is so hard because I feel like I've always failed when I've actually had like a specific resolution. I think you want to pick something that you can stick to. But that's not too easy to where, you know, you inherently feel like a failure. So I would love to say, like, I'm going to give up wine and watch reality TV and, like, become really classy this year. But, like, I would have already broken it because Vanderpump Rules premiered on Tuesday and there I was on my couch. They make really good wine in a screw top now. And every minute of it was amazing. So I didn't even try. So this year I just went with something much more broad and general. And I had a baby last year, which, as anyone who has kids knows, is like an incredibly joyful experience, but it can also be really isolating and your world becomes
very tiring.
Your world becomes very small for a long time. So one of my resolutions is, you know, to get back out there, to get outside my comfort zone and to, you know, try new things, this being one of them. So here I am.
I loved it when we had our babies because I learned about all the fascinating TV shows that are on between 2 and 4 a.m. I had no idea that it was such captivating TV on at that time. But now I have a question for you. The other day I was listening to the radio about New Year's resolutions, and someone said his resolution was to resolve not to make any New Year's resolutions. And my thought was, well, did he keep it or did he break it? I'm still thinking about that. I'm not sure which way that cuts. If you resolve to not make any New Year's resolutions, well, you just did make a New Year's resolution. So how does that actually cut?
Might be like the smartest person of all. Like, you just automatically win. It's not like you're going to like break down mid-February and like try to become a better person. Like, it's not, you know.
I can tell you. Not to say too many bad jokes, but I did hear this joke recently about you should change the name of your bathroom to Jim rather than John. That way you can see you go to the gym every morning. But nonetheless, I do want to say that one of my New Year's resolutions might be to change my diet. You're always looking to, you know, shed a few pounds, get in better shape. And RBG has a diet. And so she is, everyone knows who RBG is, right? The notorious RBG, Supreme Court Justice. And if you want a New Year's resolution, Google RBG's workout regime. Have you done that, Mackenzie?
I actually am an owner of the notorious RBG book, which outlines her program, at least as of the time that was published several years ago. And it's intense. It's like, she's
really?
Like the original CrossFitter, you know?
So, and I've heard that she does push-ups and planks every day at the Supreme Court. Does her book confirm that?
Yes. It's wild. I mean, she's like a tough cookie.
Wow. Well, the news came out this morning that she is now cancer-free. This is her fourth bout with cancer. And I got to tell you, I want her diet. Whatever her diet is, she has now beaten cancer 4 times. And I think every one of us should be adopting her, doing planks and push-ups and eating whatever RBG is eating.
She's doing something right for sure.
Well, my resolution is I want to do a podcast every week this year, except for those weeks where I don't. So I think I can make that pot. That's going to be my resolution. And so we're going to see if we can't stick to it. Well, let's start off here, Mackenzie, with the Weinstein case. I assume you're familiar with this case. Everyone's been following it for the last couple of years. Weinstein is the disgraced media mogul from New York. Actually, I guess from all over. He's in Hollywood. And so he was charged with raping a woman in 2013 in a hotel in Manhattan, and then forcibly performing a sex act on another person in 2006. So those are the two claims that are a part of these rape charges in New York. So, Mackenzie, have you been following the Weinstein case?
I've been following it pretty closely, you know, since a couple years ago when the whole story exploded, but specifically like the trial that's going on in Manhattan now, I would say I've been following pretty closely. I read about it every day.
Now, from the perspective of a female, what was your response when the entire, because this was I don't want to say it birthed the Me Too movement, but a lot of people connect the two. Well, what is your perspective on the Me Too movement and the Weinstein case?
You know, it's so complicated. It's almost reminiscent of the OJ case in the sense that there's so much of a cultural moment that's happening at the same time. And that's why I'm so interested in this case. I also, was briefly a criminal prosecutor for a couple of years, several years ago. I was, yeah.
You put people in jail?
My nickname was State Time Smith, so like, don't cross me.
How would your husband ever disagree with you?
Oh, no one ever. Well, I'm always right, so you don't have to, first of all. So it just like makes it easy.
Have you heard that joke that said, I would agree with you, but then we would both be wrong?
That's exactly right, yeah.
All right. Well, I'm very cautious now to hearing what you have to say, knowing you can put people in jail, but go on.
Right. So just these are really tough cases. And the public perception, I mean, Harvey, as you said, he's a disgraced media mogul. I think someone said in the press recently, like, is there anybody more hated in America right now than Harvey Weinstein? And there really isn't. I mean, he's just reviled. So, you know, it's an interesting case. But at the same time, if you look at the facts of this trial, it is not a slam dunk for the prosecution in any sense. First of all, there's two allegations that are on trial. The most recent one is now 7 years old. So that's a problem right from the beginning. Memories fade and, you know, the old tropes about you want recency, right? But also, I believe that the 2013 alleged victim carried on a friendly, if not more than friendly, relationship with him after the alleged rape. And he has produced emails back and forth between the two of them where she says, like, I'll always love you and things like that. So it's very complicated. It's not an easy case. The facts are really messy. And, you know, we all know because we know about the case that there have been dozens and dozens of allegations. But really, once you're inside the courtroom, hopefully you are kind of in a vacuum. And these allegations aren't what most people probably imagine that they are. So it is very interesting and it'll be really fascinating to see what happens.
Well, let's talk about the trial just a little bit. You said you are hopefully in a vacuum when you are in court. And so I assume you're referring to there will be a jury of Harvey Weinstein's peers. Now, let's just pause and think about that for a moment. How does our criminal justice system work? Are we really going to get peers of Harvey Weinstein? I mean, I know Epstein is no longer available to serve on this jury. So what kind of peers are we going to get of Harvey Weinstein? How does that work?
What other Steens are out there that have like some crazy life story? No, I know. I don't know if it's possible for him.
I've even heard one person say, would you want your fate, your freedom being determined by 12 men and women who were not smart enough to get out of jury duty? So I find this whole selection of the juries fascinating. Since you are a former prosecutor, yeah, how is this going to work?
So I read that the judge in this case is doing something, you know, a little different in this case. He's actually bringing in a panel of 120 potential jurors every day for the rest of this week. And every day they're just going through and just doing for cause, meaning if someone insists that they cannot be impartial, even, you know, after being instructed that they have to put their prejudice aside, or if they have, you know, something that would render them prejudiced against or in favor of the defendant, Harvey Weinstein, then that would be a for-cause challenge. And then after this week, they take everyone who's left from all of those, and then they go through regular voir dire, which would be, you know, each side gets to strike however many so that they end up with a jury and however many alternates they are going to have in this case. So I think it's a good procedure. I thought that was a pretty good idea. I think out of 120 the first day, they ended up with like 20-something, which I actually thought was like not bad. If they do that for 5 days in a row, they'll have 100 left for next week. So, you know,
I assume this to be correct, but tell me if you have a different understanding, but 12 jurors, is that who they're looking for to serve on this jury?
I think 12 jurors, and they might be looking for, I can't remember if it's 6 or 12 alternates, but usually in a case that's going to be, you know, any length of time, you want a lot of alternates because people's schedules, you know, things happen, people get sick. So you don't want to miss trial. You want as many alternates as you can.
I'm thinking the OJ Simpson trial was 8.5 months. I have no idea how long this trial is going to last, but yeah, I think you'd want a lot of, this one's going to be covered in the news every day. So you would definitely want plenty of alternates.
Absolutely. And, you know, as a former prosecutor, even though it was only 2 years of my life, like my opinion on this is like, I totally agree with you. People who aren't smart enough to get out of jury duty, you got to question them. But I think even more insidious is like the people who are trying to get on the jury because they're out there, believe it or not. And you got to ask, like, why?
Oh, book deals. You know, they have book deals.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. But in this age of Twitter and like, trials are public. So the public, I mean, I understand like the Me Too movement and people feel very passionately, but in my experience, like most people can make a good faith effort at least to put bias and prejudice aside. And they do really do their best to follow jury instructions. But I think, like, as much as that pressure is, like, in a case like this, the public pressure to render a certain verdict. I mean, people are going to know your name after. They might know where you live. It's scary. Like, I think there has to be an incredible amount of public pressure. And I just don't, I don't think I would handle that well. And I think it's got to be overwhelming.
It'd be fascinating to analyze this case from the perspective of the lawyers. What kind of juror would they be looking for? So I, my co-counsel on a recent case, she normally defends people who are charged with rape and really bad, bad crimes. You would, I don't even want to describe, they are so bad. And those are the kind of cases that she defends. And so she told me that she will often, during voir dire, swear. She'll just drop a cuss word right there in front of the potential jurors. And she wanted to see their reaction. Her perspective was, if they have problems with me swearing, they're not going to handle the facts of this case. So I need to get those people off the jury. Have you given any thought as to who you would want on this jury if you were the defense?
Ooh, I have not thought about it from the defense perspective. I mean, that's like a really interesting question. I think there's conventional wisdom in sexual assault cases that doesn't always pan out. I think, you know, you would think that you want all women or whatever. And as in the OJ case, although that was not sexual assault, obviously, it just goes to show that sometimes people's notions of who would be a favorable juror are so incredibly wrong that they're like almost the opposite. And I think, like, in my practice, both when I was a prosecutor and now as a civil litigator, I just try to find like the most intelligent people that I can, because I really think like if you really know your case and you work as hard as you can and outwork the other side and think of a way to make your case relatable, like an intelligent person will listen and, you know, try to understand where you're coming from. So that's, I mean, really, at the end of the day, obviously, you don't want someone who's like wearing a hashtag Me Too t-shirt in court if you're Weinstein's attorney. Like, it's not going to go well right for you. But other than that, like, I would want someone who seemed to be a deliberate person, maybe someone who, you know, is an engineer or is a logical thinker. And then I would try to present the most logical case possible and, dispassionate. That's what I would do.
I even heard from one lawyer that he asked during voir dire what a bumper stickers these people have on their cars. Because if you are a real radical person for whatever cause, you very well might have some bumper stickers on your car that might, you know, elucidate how strongly you feel about that particular issue. And so that might be also a portal into what a person is thinking. Well, I obviously, sexual harassment is not a laughing matter, so I don't mean to make light of that. I will tell you this one personal story. I was asked to speak on the subject of sexual harassment by this particular business group, and I don't want to give you the name of this group, but they wanted me to come and talk about sexual harassment, and they knew I was the comedian of law, so they said, look, our one guide here is we want you to make this topic funny. And I just go, what did I ever do to you that you want me to torpedo my career? You can't make sexual harassment funny. But believe it or not, I actually was able to do that by making fun of lawyers. No matter what the topic is, everyone loves to make fun of lawyers. Well, nonetheless, that being said, there are some interesting aspects to this case. Did you catch the cell phone incident in this case?
Harvey. I don't know what he was thinking. Apparently he was like, I don't know if he was texting or what he was doing in court, and had the judge already admonished him to put it away and he kept doing it? Is that what happened? Like, I don't know what it was, but he needed to get yelled at.
Yeah, we don't know, but here's what we do know. During the middle of the court proceeding, Harvey thought, you know what? Now's a good time to check my Facebook page. Maybe there's some funny jokes there. He is perusing his cell phone during court. I can't even imagine someone having the audacity to do that. And here's what the judge said. Judge Burke scolded Weinstein and said, Mr. Weinstein, I cannot implore you more to not answer the following question. Is this really the way you want to end up in jail for the rest of your life, by texting in violation of an order? Is it? And that's what the judge asked Harvey Weinstein in the middle of trial. And I assume that's never happened to you in any of your cases?
No, I mean, I've seen people get yelled at, just like random people in the courtroom get yelled at for being on their phones, you know, and kicked out of the courtroom or something like that. But I've never seen that from a defendant. And am I correct that the defense filed a recusal motion after that because the judge said, is this the way you want to end up in jail for the rest of your life? I mean, the whole thing, what a mess. I mean, it's just such a mess. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and judge guilt or innocence. Like, I don't do that. I have no idea how this case is going to turn out, but it does come off and it's just so incredibly disrespectful. And his lawyers really should have controlled that. I mean, it's gross.
We like to keep a collection of worst legal advice of all time. I had a person on our podcast recently where he does a website where all he talks about is the worst legal advice given. Maybe we can add to that telling your client, yeah, it's okay to check your Facebook page during argument, during trial. That probably would not be the best legal advice of all time. Well, more to your point, the defense did call those comments by the judge prejudicial and inflammatory, and then asked for the court to be recused, or the judge to be recused from this case. No word yet on how the court's going to rule on that. I'm assuming the court will deny that. But yeah, that was something that the defense filed. One last thing about this case I want to throw by your attention. Gloria Allred, who is an attorney, and she also represents some of the witnesses in this case, witnesses who were victims, alleged victims of Harvey Weinstein from sexual abuse. And so she represents them, but she also is listed as a potential witness in this case. Well, the defense asked for her to be banned from court. Now, I got to tell you, I don't practice in criminal law. I'm in the civil law case. That's standard. It is standard if you're a potential witness in a case, you can ask the court for that witness to be banned from the courtroom because you don't want them hearing everyone else's testimony, and that might then guide how they are going to testify. So you can ask for all potential witnesses to be removed from the court. So what is your take on this request, which, by the way, was denied, that Gloria Allred be banned from the court?
So it actually is completely routine. You ask for sequestration pretty much in every case. I can't think of a case where there would be a good reason not to, you know, other than when you're the prosecutor, your affiant, which would typically be the cop who wrote the criminal complaint, or the detective, is allowed to stay. That was the case in my jurisdiction, at least. I don't know, because I don't know what, see, there's two different ways this could be. She could be on a witness list just so that, you know, as gamesmanship, so that they could ask for her to be removed, in which case, you know, you have to call BS. It's kind of like a pretextual thing. But if she actually is a witness, then, you know, I mean, why should she get special treatment, especially if she represents other potential witnesses who are also being sequestered? You know, my only concern as an attorney would be, I don't want my client in the courtroom without me there. But if her clients are also being sequestered, you know, maybe she could be present when they're on the stand, but not throughout the entire trial. So I don't know.
So you might be thinking this is a little bit of gamesmanship by the defense lawyers calling him as a witness. And so let's move on now to our Supreme Court. And last year, December 31st, the last day of the year, apparently that is report card time at the Supreme Court. And so the Chief Justice John Roberts issued his 2019 year-end report on the federal judiciary. Now, did you get a chance to review this report card by our Chief Justice?
I did. I stan Justice Roberts. I'm a big fan. I think he's a beautiful writer, so I try to read as much as I can of anything that he comes out with.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I want to comment on, because I teach my continuing education classes where I implore people to add humor to their lives. It does make for a better life if you can incorporate humor into your daily lives. Here it is. Second paragraph, our Chief Justice in his end of the year report card drops a joke. And I thought that's pretty appropriate. I'm going to use that in my class. If the Chief Justice finds it appropriate to crack jokes in his report card to the federal judiciary, I think we all can add a little bit of humor to our lives. Let me set the stage for this joke. Basically, he's starting off his report card by talking about the Federalist Papers, but how great they were, how they kind of guided the founding of our republic. And so he mentioned that there were three authors to the Federalist Papers: Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. And in fact, those three wrote under the shared pseudonym of Publius. But then he noted that because John Jay suffered an accident, he did not write as much as the other two persons. So this was his joke, he said. Perhaps if Jay had been more productive, America might rewarded him with a Broadway musical. There you go. I'm not sure that goes down in the annals of open night or late night comedians as the funniest joke out there, but at least he tried. He attempted. And Mackenzie, that's what counts. It's what is in the heart that counts. He tried to drop a joke. Well, what did you think? Was it funny?
I thought it was cute. And, you know, I think the gist of the report was, you know, we have to maintain the public's trust in the judiciary, you know, through civic education and other, you know, mechanisms that he talks about. But he seemed really concerned with, you know, not only the court's reputation, but the whole judiciary, you know, as a whole. And I think he just is trying to be relatable. I thought it came off as cute. And I think he is, you know, he is funny here and there. He's definitely not like the funniest Supreme Court justice that's ever walked the face of the earth. But I liked it. And I'm a big fan. So
since you brought up the topic, who is the funniest justice? I've gone through now 15 years of Supreme Court argument. I document every single time there was laughter at the Supreme Court over the last 15 years. Let me just put you on the spot. Who do you think has been the funniest justice for the last 15 years?
I mean, I would have to say Scalia.
And it's not even close. By far and away, he is the funniest justice. He is hilarious. He's come up with such great lines as, this is pure jiggery pokery. Or the majority opinion is pure applesauce. I mean, this guy, he could drop the, he can engage in judicial trash talk. Well, nonetheless, who is number two? Who do you think was the second funniest justice over the last 15 years?
Are we talking about in oral argument?
During oral argument, yes. I document every single time there was laughter at the Supreme Court for 15 years. And I associate that laughter with the justice who told the joke. And so number one, by far and away, was Scalia, funniest justice out there, who came in at number two.
Okay, so I know like it's not going to be Clarence Thomas because he doesn't talk, right?
We're not really big into silent comedy, right? The silent film thing he might be good at, but no, he did not come in at number two.
Is it RBG?
No, she is funny, but I hear she is funnier in her private life, but not necessarily at the Supreme Court, at least at this stage. Maybe it's her comedic timing that might be off since she is somewhat frail. Number two might surprise you. It is Justice Breyer.
Uh-oh.
By far and away, he is a very, think about a Bob Newhart kind of style of delivery. He has a deadpan kind of delivery. A very funny justice. Now probably the reigning champion. But number three would be the Chief Justice John Roberts. So you are right. He is pretty funny. He does have a funny bone in him. Now, he did say this on this report card. He said that when judges render their judgments through written opinions that explain their reasoning, they advance public understanding of the law. Now, what is your take on that?
Like, I love his optimism and his belief in the public. I just don't envision many people like sitting down Friday night to read judicial opinions. I just like, it's hard for me sometimes, and I do this for a living. So, you know, I think it might be like, he might want to take kind of a more, like, if he really wants to engage the public, like, why can't they do like take a more Trumpian stance and just like tweet their opinions, like hashtag overruled or whatever. I mean, that would engage more people. I don't know if it would increase the integrity of the judiciary.
Mackenzie, you are brilliant. That is genius. You need to contact the Chief Justice. Hey, forget about these opinions. Come on. I hate to break the news to you, Chief. No one's reading them. I mean, I'm glad you're pouring your heart and soul, but unless you have a JD at the end of your name and you're arguing a case, nobody is really reading these opinions. I found it hilarious. He even cited to the Brown v. Topeka Board of Education case as an example of a great way to educate the public. That was 11 pages. Yeah, it was also 1,100 years ago. No one is even reading 11 pages today. As you said, put it in a tweet. And so I think that that's how they should now do all future Supreme Court opinions. You got to render your opinion in 140 characters or less. And so I think that's a genius idea, Mackenzie. I love it.
I'd read them all.
Yeah, you would. All right, well, let's move on. Well, talking about the Supreme Court, next week there's an interesting term at the Supreme, interesting cases that have come up. I mentioned the three of them, but one of them in particular I want to cover, the Kelly v. United States case. Now, this case fascinated me. When I read this case, the description of it, it sounds like this is coming right from a government mafia movie. Now, I talked to you a little bit about this case beforehand. This involves, is it the George Washington Bridge?
Yeah.
Now, you've been on that bridge.
So many times. It's horrible.
And I've understood you've said a lot of swear words on that bridge. Is that also correct? And tell me about your experience and how that relates to this case.
I mean, I just feel like anyone who's ever lost their mind, stuck on the lower deck for like 2 hours in traffic, knows where I'm coming from. And there are a lot of people, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the most heavily trafficked bridge in the world.
Okay, just stop right there, my kids. I'm from Kansas City, all right? You lost me on lower deck, because we don't have decks to our bridges, all right? So right there, you're in a totally different world. This has multiple decks to the bridge?
There's two. You guys, so what you have, you don't have decks on your bridges. You have a playoff bye. That's what you guys get. And like great barbecue, I've heard. So you're
great
winning.
Barbecue,
like,
right.
Trust me, you're winning.
Okay, all right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's two decks. I think one goes into the city and one goes out of the city. So the George Washington Bridge is like at the end of the Jersey Turnpike. I'm not a New Yorker, but, you know, I used to go up there all the time, still on occasion. And it goes into the Bronx, actually, from New Jersey. So there's one deck that goes one way and one deck that goes the other way. Or is it local traffic or express? I can't even remember, but there's definitely two levels and there's so many lanes. It's like a nightmare.
And my understanding is that during rush hour, there are three lanes that are dedicated exclusively for going from, let's see if I can get this straight, it's the George Washington Bridge. This is the busiest bridge in the world. And there are 12 toll lanes going from New Jersey into New York. And three of these lanes are devoted to going to a town called Fort Lee, New Jersey. And so have you been on that bridge?
Yeah, so it's Fort Lee is like the city that's right across the river, you know, right where the bridge begins, I guess. And so they had an agreement with the Port Authority, who operates the bridge, that three of the toll lanes would be for people coming, local traffic coming from this town, because they're, you know, most of the people in the town are, I don't want to say most, but like a lot of people in town commute into the city. So it made sense and alleviated traffic.
So apparently there's a Democratic mayor of Fort Lee. I have no idea if he's the current mayor, but Mark Sokolich was the Democratic mayor. And apparently his endorsement was sought for Chris Christie, who was the Republican governor of New Jersey at that time. And so they wanted his endorsement. He would not give it, and which to me sounds rather reasonable. I mean, I don't see too many Democratic politicians endorsing Republican politicians, but nonetheless, that, I guess, ticked off the some people there at the Port Authority. And so one person's name was David Wilderstein. He was a Port Authority staffer. And he mentioned to this other person named Bridget Ann Kelly, who was Christie's deputy chief of staff, that the Port Authority could, and I quote, close down those Fort Lee lanes on the bridge to put some pressure on Sokolich. Is that not mafia tactics? I mean, this could be a very interesting movie.
It's like, I mean, it is New Jersey we're talking about, but to me, it's crazy. And I think her response was like, it's time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. Like, you can't write, you can't make it up. It's like worse than what you would write if you were writing a screenplay. It's so bad.
And what do we tell our clients? I mean, I don't know if you tell your clients this, but I got to admit, you don't put things in writing. When you put things in writing, it's going to come back to bite you in the butt. And so you're going to put that in an email. Has this person never heard of a FOIA request? This information will come out, which it did. And so apparently this all came to light. And so there were some, obviously the public was outraged, right? You're going to shut down traffic. Can you just imagine the traffic congestion that existed for those 3 days while they shut down those three lanes into Fort Lee?
I think there were like, people were stuck for hours. People had to, like, there were EMTs who had to get out of their ambulance and walk to go help. So, I mean, it was really bad. There's a mess. for sure.
So they had this, they create this huge traffic congestion just because this mayor would not endorse Chris Christie for the governorship. And so apparently after 3 days, the Port Authority executive officer found out about it, and she shut this down, reopened up the lanes, and then all these people that were involved lost their jobs. Either they were forced to resign or they were fired. But that is not the end of the story, because a criminal investigation was commenced against these three individuals for, was it wire fraud?
I think it was wire fraud, yeah.
So explain how that kind of prosecution, how would you make your case of wire fraud involving governmental property here against these three individuals?
So my understanding is the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is like a joint agency, and it's heavily federally funded. And the right. wire fraud statute says you can't defraud a federally funded program. So when this woman, Kelly, from Chris Christie's office and her counterpart at the Port Authority decided they need to shut down these lanes, they concocted a story that they were going to conduct a traffic study. And it was a completely fake study. It didn't exist, but they told the Port Authority, like, this is what we're doing. You have to shut down these lanes. And the Port Authority actually dedicated resources. They had to like hire an extra toll collector for those 3 days. They dedicated like other resources to, I think they actually had people studying the traffic, like who didn't even know their own study was a fake study.
Okay. So they were actually studying the traffic.
Oh, they. I think they actually did study the traffic. Wait a second. Wait a second.
I got to just pause there. Let's just unpack that. Okay. Here's the thing we want to study. If we shut down three lanes of traffic, what impact is that going to have on traffic? You know what? I think I know what the answer is here. Go ahead and save yourself a bunch of money. It's going to congest it, right? That's what's going to happen. It's going to create traffic jam and gridlock when you shut down three lanes of traffic. But
yeah,
hey,
you can put it in a tweet. It's really bad. Like it's 140 characters or less. Really bad.
Wow. Well, so that is, they were studying this traffic jam. So you have this wire fraud. I believe there's two elements that are needed here. You will need government property and then some kind of fraudulent assertment. So were those two things present in this case?
So I think the bigger question is whether there was government property at issue, because I think there was, you know, there were resources that the Port Authority dedicated to this issue. But I think most of it was like employee time, which is intangible. And the actual money that was spent was something like $5,400. So it was pretty de minimis in the grand scheme of things. So that's the main argument, I think, is that there was no actual property at issue.
All right. Now I got to tell you, Mackenzie, what I want to focus on here is the precedent that might be set. Because I got to tell you, I represent a lot of governmental entities, and I'm sure you have represented them in the past as well. And here's the deal. Sometimes what the government says it's doing is not really what the government is actually doing.
People are you serious?
I know. It's like, well, whether there's pretext, there's pretense. Oh, no. I believed everything that Trump is tweeting. Well, nonetheless, because of that, is this opening up Pandora's box for all kinds of criminal actions that can be threatened against other politicians? I have a specific case for us to consider. This is the a case involving the citizenship question, where there was a Supreme Court case, came down, I believe it was last term. And in that case, the thought was that the government's real reason for winning that citizenship question on the census is not because they cared about how many citizens were in that household. They wanted the effect that this asking the question would have on the responses. And the fewer responses would, I guess, mean more Republicans in that area. And it would enhance the Republican percentage or representation in Congress. And that was the actual purpose. So here's what I'm getting at. If this case were successful, and can you now criminalize almost any governmental action where their real reason is not the stated reason?
Well, I don't think so, because I think in the census question, there is no property at issue, first of all. And second of all, it was the governmental entity taking the action, whereas in the Kelly case, you have, I mean, Kelly wasn't an employee of the Port Authority. She was an employee of Chris Christie's office, and she like literally defrauded the Port Authority. I mean, I understand that typically when you defraud, well, I don't typically defraud anyone, but typically when people defraud other
when you typically defraud people, I get it, yeah.
When I defraud people, they're looking for personal gain, and, you know, I guess you can argue that there's no personal gain here to Kelly, but she definitely lied, and, you know, the Port Authority relied on the lie to its detriment. Whereas with the census question, I don't necessarily think it's exactly parallel, but I will say I can see why this case makes a lot of people nervous, and it'll be interesting to see how it comes out.
Let me give you another hypothetical, which might play closer to home, but snow is coming upon us. And so and this actually happened to me when I lived in Florida on a similar context. But nonetheless, snow is coming. And would it be a criminal act if the snowplows, they first go to a particular section of town that mayor wanted their vote? So let's say a mayor is courting a certain vote from a certain section of town. Could the mayor then order the snow plows to plow that section of town first after a snowstorm? Or would that now be subject to a criminal prosecution?
Well, I think the mayor has the power to do that, right? So it makes him a terrible mayor, but I think he can do it because he's not. Oh my gosh, this is leading me to the conclusion that you can lie to the public, but you can't lie to the government. This is terrible. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, I guess it's like, you know, when I lie, it's a crime, and when the government lies, it's politics.
It's going to be a fascinating way to see how the court comes down with this issue. I think what's going to be critical to the court's analysis is the underlying action of the study, the traffic study. Clearly, that's not legitimate here, but can they make an argument that in some sense it was a legitimate study and that they just chose now as a time to do that study? I think that's going to be a critical issue in this case. If it is totally bogus and fraudulent, then they're going to have a tough defense there. But nonetheless, that case is going to be argued this week. I'm sure it's going to be fascinating and probably a decision coming down next July. But now we will be following that case here during our podcast. All right, two other cases that might come up next week or that will be coming up. Babb v. Wilkie. This involved age discrimination. So can you just briefly set up what that case is about?
So this is the issue in this case, I think, is the federal sector provision of the federal age discrimination statute. And there is a Supreme Court case that addresses the rest of the provisions that apply to, you know, the private sector under certain circumstances. And in those cases, the wording of the statute is you can't discriminate against an employee because of their age. And the court has said, you know, that the employee has the onus to prove that it's a but-for, that the adverse employment decision was like a but-for cause. And the issue here is the federal sector provision, which has different wording, which says that the employment action must be free from any discrimination based on age. So the plaintiff is a employee who had some adverse employment actions. And I guess the statute says, you know, if you're over 40 and it's based on age, you know, you can bring a federal discrimination or a discrimination lawsuit. I was like, felt targeted by this because I'm really towing the line of being old enough to be a potential plaintiff under the statute. Like, does 40 seem like way too young to you?
Now, Mackenzie, stop right there. I'm calling BS. You are nowhere near old. I saw you in my class. Are you, you're close to 40?
I'm close to 40. And like, I'm not in as good of shape as RBG. Like, I'm joining the huddled masses here, but it's,
you know what?
It is a little jarring when you see that in a statute, like, oh my gosh, I'm a protected class almost.
You know what? It's just going to get worse. Let me tell you, I was 45. a couple of years ago. We'll go with a couple. I turned 45. I got that letter from the AARP in the mailbox, and my wife just loved it. Yes, you are hard getting mail from the AARP. I wanted to burn that. But nonetheless, we all get older. You know what? It beats the alternative. But I do get it. Age discrimination is going to happen to us all. Let me see if I understand what this case is about. So when you're talking about the but-for issue, that's going to be central to this case. So let's say that Josie is 50 years old, all right, and she loves to sleep. She's a night owl, and she loves to sleep late. She comes in late to work every single day. And so if when they fire Josie for showing up to work late, they mention, and, you know, you are old, but you failed to show up at work on time, so we're going to fire you. So the issue is, yes, they mentioned her age when they fired her, but she also failed to show up to work on time for 3 months in a row. And so in that context, but for her age, would she have been fired? Yeah, she still would have been fired because she did not show up to work on time. So did I properly characterize the issue of the but for issue in this case?
Correct. So that would not be, she would have gotten fired anyway. So there was no discrimination in that circumstance. I think in this case, there were kind of several factors. I think the allegation was gender and age and maybe something else. So it's not clear, is my understanding, that it was that age was a quote unquote but for cause of the adverse action. Just like note, if you are in-house counsel somewhere and like I'm not an employment lawyer, but like, you know, if your client is firing people and saying, and also you're old, like you probably should sit down with those people and like have a chat.
Button it up, zip it up. Don't talk about the person's appearance. Hey, great advice for employers out there and also for the president of the United States. But nonetheless, I do think that is a unifying issue. I don't care if you are conservative, liberal, Republican, or Democrat. We all can unify on take his Twitter password away from him. But nonetheless, let's move on to my last case I want to talk about today. This is a settlement this last week. CNN settles the Nick Sandman defamation lawsuit. I assume you followed this lawsuit of Covington Catholic High School. A group of students went to this pro-life rally in Washington, D.C., and they are just congregating afterwards. And this person, this indigenous American, apparently has a confrontation, and it is reported in the media that it was these Covington High School kids' fault. They instigated it. They said all kinds of bad things. Turns out that wasn't the case. They were not the instigators. They were just kind of receiving the backlash from these other individuals and groups. And so nonetheless, CNN was sued along with, I believe, let's just say 8 or 10 other news organizations for, I believe the highest number was $800 million. Nonetheless, CNN agreed to settle their part of the dispute this last week. It's been rumored for about $25 million, though that is just a rumor. It's confidential. No one actually knows what that amount is. Well, Mackenzie, what is your take on this case?
This case makes me so uncomfortable. I think the whole thing was just so unfortunate. The incident itself and the way it was covered and, you know, the inflammatory reaction to it. So legally speaking, the lawsuit against CNN, my understanding, was for $800 million. And I understand it's mostly punitive damages for libel. And I understand, you know, what punitive damages are. And CNN's a huge corporation. It just seems like a lot. I did, you know, briefly look over the complaint and I'm not sure I could really pick out an actual defamatory statement that CNN even allegedly made. There are words in the complaint like there was a defamatory gist to the coverage. So, like, I'm a big First Amendment person. The phrase defamatory gist makes me kind of nauseous. Like, that.
That's what the complaint said, a defamatory gist?
Yeah, it didn't really pass the smell test to me. So I don't like the fact that CNN settled this. I'm uncomfortable with the whole thing. You know, that said, legalities aside, I will say it's a terrible look the way that this was covered. When you have a political analyst from CNN going on Twitter shortly after, you know, the incident happened and saying, this kid is a disgrace. He should get punched in the face. I mean, that, like, there's no, there's nothing, you know, that the free press needs to say like that. Like, it's just, it shouldn't have happened. I think that is why people get so mad at quote unquote knee-jerk liberalism. Like, that was the textbook of a knee-jerk reaction. It shouldn't have happened. And we all kind of had knee-jerk reactions to this incident. And it was sobering when you kind of found out the way it really went down, and you have to look at yourself and say, like, wow, I really did not have all the facts when I had an opinion, you know, and you don't want to do that.
Let's unpack that for just a bit, because the more I'm thinking about it, I kind of understand what they mean by saying gist. Now, let me just give you a couple quick stories on what I'm talking about. I had a case in El Paso, Texas, and we were suing. I represented a group that was suing to recall the mayor of El Paso. And so I was lead counsel, and I was there in court every single day observing the proceedings and you know, arguing the case, calling the witnesses, things like that. It was reported in the media every single day. It was covered in the media. And as I read the media's coverage of the trial, my first thought was, were they actually at the same trial I was at? Because that sounds nothing like the trial that I am lead counsel of. And so sometimes the way in which media reports on something can really distort, even though they will defend themselves by saying, well, technically I didn't say anything inaccurate. Still, the way in which you tell the story is blatantly biased, and that's just my personal observation from a story that I was involved with. My response was, were you even in the same courtroom? Now, let's go to this particular case, the Covington case. I had no involvement with any of these parties. I just watched the news report like anyone else did. I watched the video coverage. I read the news report, and my first reaction was, these punks. I can't believe they would embarrass a conservative name like this. You know, they are acting like jerks. I would assure my kid would never act like that. Man, my kid would get a whooping when he came home after treating some, you know, indigenous American that way. That was what actually went through my brain in reading these reports. Now, I can't tell you if it was CNN's report, but pretty much they were all the exact same. They're all just parroting what other people were saying. And I was misled. And so the more I dug into it, I realized, no, the story is 100% the opposite direction. And so the issue is, yeah, I could see how there was the wrong message that was sent via the gist of the reporting. They were definitely communicating the wrong message. Should someone be held liable for that? Or should we just simply allow that to go on and say, no, prove your defamation. Just, yeah, good luck at that.
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. And you know, I don't know the right answer to it, I guess. I mean, I guess my gut reaction is like the cure for bad speech is more speech. And what really disturbs me as a liberal is when people won't admit that they were wrong. Right. You know, you have to come out and say, like, I understand the way some people on a certain side of the aisle would have liked this to have gone down, but it's also not the way it did go down, and it isn't the truth. And if you made a prejudgment and didn't have all the facts, like, you do have an obligation to come out and admit that. And I think, you know, as a litigator, you always tell your clients, or really any witness that you put on the stand, like, when you concede bad facts, or when you, you know, get out in front of bad facts, you take the wind out of everyone else's sails and you become much more credible and you endear yourself to the jury. And I think it's a similar situation. Like, if you come out and admit, like, look, I prejudged this, I didn't have all the facts, it looked one way, and I reported on it, or I made a comment on it, and it actually wasn't that way, it takes a lot of wind out of this story, and kind of diffuses it.
You brought up a real interesting point, which is maybe the response to bad speech is more speech. And I believe that conservatives and liberals all are in agreement with that. At least there are several Supreme Court opinions where you'll hear both liberal and conservative justices agree with that thought. And did that play out here? Well, maybe it did, because after the false, or I'll say the false reports came out at first, it was corrected. And I, in myself, even though I was misled at first, I then became corrected in my thought, and I no longer had the same negative feelings about these individuals. So maybe you're right. Maybe in this case, this is an example of where this problem was resolved with more speech.
Yeah, I think it was. I think, you know, a lot of people could have done better. And I think it was a case where we all kind of have to learn from it. And that, and like, I think the Jussie Smollett thing was going on at the same time. And, you know, we all kind of had to take a step back and say, like, whoa, okay, the news cycle's too fast. We are just consuming sound bites, and our brains want to connect these puzzle pieces, and we don't have enough pieces to see what the big picture is sometimes. And, you know, it was a lesson for me. Like, I also felt very passionately about it one way and then was totally proven wrong and had to, you know, eat my thoughts, if not my words. So luckily I didn't tweet anything horrific about this individual, but.
Wow. Those are very wise words there, because I'm tracking exactly what you're saying. I had horrible thoughts about this person, and then I went 180 degrees the other direction. And so maybe we are better to bite our tongue until we get the rest of the story. The downside of that is we live in a day and age where if you don't report on it within minutes, it's old news. And so, man, I know you are just a young person under the age of 40. I'm on the other side of 40. I remember when we had to wait until the next morning to read the news. And now, yeah, if you're reading about it in the newspaper, that might as well be the Encyclopedia Brown. I mean, that is just old news right there if you have to wait until the next day. Yeah, I want to now shift gears here just a bit, because we have a lot of great headlines that we talked about. It's going to be a great, interesting year as we unpack the Supreme Court, interesting cases that come up. But I want to now talk about Hollywood. I'm a big movie buff. Do you like attending movies, watching movies?
I love it.
So what kind of movies? If you had a holiday evening, what kind of movie are you going to watch? Let me just set the stage for you. And this actually is a true story. Let's say on a particular day, Downton Abbey is coming out with their movie. It coincides that exact same day Rambo is being released in the theaters. Which one are you going to, Rambo or Downton Abbey?
Oh, Downton Abbey all day, every day. Like, I'll take a good period piece over almost anything. For real.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, yes. So my wife did not join me in going to see Rambo, and I did not join her in seeing Downton Abbey. She found someone else to go with. But nonetheless, that kind of is my perspective on movies. But I love lawyer movies. In fact, I teach about those in my class. I like to get all different examples of lawyer movies. I like to collect. I had to watch almost every legal movie out there in preparation for my class. By the way, I have a great job. I love my job. I have to watch movies in preparation for my class. Now, do you enjoy a good lawyer movie?
Oh, of course. I think it's, you know, one of the pleasures of being a lawyer is watching courtroom dramas, especially, but like any legal themed movie, and feeling like you're better than the person next to you because you know more of what they're talking about, or you think you know
exactly
what's wrong.
Exactly. Have you ever done this? You're watching a lawyer show, whatever. You hit pause and you tell the person sitting next to you, that's ridiculous. There is no way that would ever happen in real court. That is nowhere close to being a real depiction of the legal profession.
I mean, look, I really want to give you like one answer, but if you called my husband and asked him, he would give you a completely different answer that is much less flattering to me. Like, it's going to shock you, but I can be a little bit of like a know-it-all motor mouth during these things. And I feel like I say it all. I'm like, that violates due process. I sometimes have been known to like object to the television.
I object, Your Honor. I object.
It definitely happens. I'm sure it's like not that fun to watch these things with me. So
I tell you what, one of my favorite shows on right now is called Bluff City Law. It's based in Memphis, Tennessee. And the lead character, have you seen this TV show?
No.
Okay. You got to watch. It is a fun TV show. I enjoy it. I watch it every week that it's on. But in one particular show, they were suing someone. I forget now the nature of the lawsuit, but they're suing a corporation for, I think it's pollution, whatever. And then later on, they find, you know what? There might be someone else who's responsible for this. They were talking about it over breakfast. That afternoon, they were deposing that company in court. I'm going, no, it does not happen that fast, where that morning you think of adding a party to your case, and by lunchtime you are deposing them in court. Things just don't move that fast.
That would be crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And another one of my favorite ones is, I assume you've seen this, like you'll watch a crime show and the opening scene in the show is a murder happened, right? Like in Bull, a murder happened. You go to commercial break. You come back from commercial break, boom, they're seating the jury. It's that fast, you know, murder before commercial, right after commercial. Hey, let's get ready for a trial. Things don't happen that fast. So nonetheless,
you're really taking the Bill of Rights seriously and swift trial.
Exactly. You're entitled to a trial before the second commercial break. Well, nonetheless, I am trying to come up with my own Academy Awards. I believe that the actual Academy Awards is going to be held on February 9th, 2020. And so I got to admit, I never watched those. But nonetheless, I always like to check up afterwards and see if my favorite movies won. They never do. But nonetheless, Rocky and Rambo, once again, is going to be screwed by the Academy. But nonetheless, I want to come up with my own Academy Awards for the legal profession. Now, some movies. I want to come up with a list of movies. And so I'm going to ask you, do you have some ideas, some nominations for best movies that involve the legal profession?
Yeah. Okay. So I have two nominees for best picture, and I'm boring because the leads in each of those movies are also my nominees for best actor and best actress. I am from the Philadelphia area, so I would be remiss and reviled if I did not nominate Philadelphia. But
good
even
movie.
If I didn't have to, I would nominate it anyway. This is it's the second movie that I ever cried at. The first was The Lion King. Mufasa was a hero.
Whoa, back up. Lion King?
Yeah, Mufasa was a hero, and his death really shook me. I mean, it did. But you know who else
I cried
was a hero?
During the live-action line. What's that?
Oh, did you?
Well, I cried during the live action Lion King because they messed up the whole Scar scene. You know the Scar scene I'm talking about? Scar sings his song, Be Prepared, Be Prepared.
Yeah, and he's like Hitler.
Oh, great, great song. Love that scene. Hilarious. Well, in the live action, they butchered the entire thing, and I was ticked. But nonetheless, you cried during Lion King, and Mufasa was a hero. But go on, I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
Look, I was 12 when it came out. I mean, it could just be hormonal. I don't know. But I definitely cried when Mufasa died. But I also cried when Andy Beckett died because he's also a hero. And actually, also Denzel was a hero. I can't remember his character's name off the top of my head, but what a great team. What a great movie. It's just wonderful. And I nominate it, and I nominate Tom Hanks as best actor. My other nomination for best picture is Aaron Brockovich because who sees this movie and doesn't want to be a lawyer fighting for justice or a legal assistant fighting for justice? Julia Roberts is amazing in that movie. I just think it's awesome and, one of the best movies of the last several decades. So those are my two nominations.
Remind me, I've seen the movie. And of course, I'm a big Julia Roberts fan. Who's not? But nonetheless, what was that movie about? Was it about water?
Yeah, so that was a movie it's a toxic tort case, and it is based on a true story. I mean, it's actually based on her real name. It's Erin Brockovich in real life. So it all really happened. And yeah, she was I think she was a single mom, legal assistant to this lawyer, kind of doing routine work, and just kind of discovered this cluster of, I can't remember if it was cancer or some kind of other illness in this community that was at the site, the dump site of some horrible polluting company. And she kind of worked the case up through just grit and hard work and not knowing really anything about the law in this area, just persisted until, the lawyer kind of agreed to take on the case and they end up winning. And it was a huge victory. It's very similar to, there's another movie called A Civil Action with John Travolta, which is also a toxic tort case. It's similar.
Huge John Travolta fan.
Yeah. So it's very similar to that movie, just with Julia Roberts instead of John Travolta. So I'm Team Roberts, and I'm nominating her.
All right. All right. We got our first nominations in. Thank you so much. Well, thank you so much, Mackenzie, for joining us today. I really do appreciate it. And so I definitely appreciate your take on these different big cases that are out there. And hopefully we can talk to you about future cases as they come down the pike. So thank you so much, Ron. I appreciate having you today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law, especially with the Supreme Court now in session, and we'll be reporting on the Supreme Court news as it happens. So I want to give a special shout-out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom, well, let's just face it, this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. For those of you that hear me in person, yeah, you know exactly what I am talking about. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.